groundwater management plan. We have Mr. Jeremiah Puget, the Sonoma County Water Agency and the USGS here. And Mr. Grant Hicks.
All right, good afternoon, board members. Vice Chair Norin, I'm Jeremiah Puget, environmental scientist of your staff. Today we're going to be talking about groundwater management and particularly focus on the efforts performed locally right here in the basin that you are now on top of. So the presentation today, we're going to provide a quick regional overview for you. We're going to get some local perspectives and then a robust presentation. We are going to turn the fire hose on you a little bit with some of the information coming your way as far as the basin characterization and the flow model. We're going to talk about the implementation of the management plan, and in the next steps we'll provide some concluding comments, and then as we move along, if you have questions for our presenters, feel free at our panelists at the end to make comment or inquire. So this slide shows us a depiction of the existing groundwater management plans, with the exception of one that we're going to go into great detail today. There's a few peppered throughout the North Coast region, and what this really shows us is in the presence of these plans is a particular need or a particular issue, as you note there in Mendocino and then up in the actually the adjudicated basin in Scott, also noting to there. These plans are voluntary, as is the one that you'll be hearing a little bit more about. And we figured we'd talk a little bit about the new legislation, since it's a forefront topic and high importance to the state right now. Groundwater is very much in the forefront of people's minds. And this was a three-bill package composed of AB 1739, SB 1168, and SB 1319. I believe board member Steve Moore has given us a lot of highlights and updates as things have moved along. I just wanted to highlight some of the important dates that this actually lays out, and that it will be requiring the high and medium priority basins, as determined by the California Department of Water Resources, to develop a groundwater sustainability agency by 2017. The DWR will be working on guidance and BMPs and outlining the necessary components of those groundwater sustainability plans. Those sustainability agencies are given until 2020 or 2022, depending on local circumstances, to develop those plans. And the goal is to achieve sustainability, which is actually being defined in this legislation, 20 years after the plan. Of course, one of the big things in this is that there is state assistance, oversight, and intervention. We want to focus primarily right now on the assistance and the oversight, as we think that that'll be a key part of moving groundwater protection, as we'll hear more about in the future in the triennial review as well, forward in our region, and have great examples here to provide for you. So really quick, oh, and I'd be remiss if I forgot to mention that the passage of Proposition 1 allocates a tremendous amount of funding for the implementation of this legislation. So talking a little bit about the details of the ranking done by the Department of Water Resources, we do not have any high priority basins in our region, but we do have, as you see, 8 priority basins. Santa Rosa Plain being one of them, Shasta Valley, Smith River, Tule Lake, Ukiah Valley, Eel River Valley, Scott River Valley, and also Butte Valley. Now, one of the things that the Department of Water Resources needs to do is to re-rank or finalize some of the rankings by the end of 2015. So some of these may change, but I'm comfortable saying not likely that we'll see a massive change. And these basins account for 60% of the population in Region 1 and 80% of the estimated groundwater use, which I find to be a fascinating statistic. And you'll note that we have our presence, the Regional Water Board, in these basins in the form of TMDL implementation, watershed stewardship, the development of the future agricultural permits, as well as the existing work that has been done by our groundwater cleanups group and any discharges of waste to land as well. So now shifting, focusing more on the area that again we're on top of right now, the Santa Rosa Plain. Our role in the development of this plan was limited, and as it should be, and as the legislation has put it into the hands of the locals. And quite frankly, the Sonoma County Water Agency has been very proactive and really ahead of the curve as far as our region and even the state is concerned. So our role has been observational and available as needed to provide any input or feedback if needed. We did provide them with a presentation describing what it is, who we are, what we do in the realm of groundwater cleanups and the various programs that affect groundwater, as well as telling them about our planning initiatives to develop that groundwater protection policy and any basin plan amendments, such as the amendment to the water quality objectives and specifically the change to chemical constituents and groundwater toxicity. In addition, we wanted to continue to remain engaged with these great proactive efforts. And so regarding these proactive and voluntary efforts, it should be noted that, again, I will reiterate that they really are years ahead of what the requirements of the legislation are. And I'll leave more of that detail to be discussed by our other panelists. And our next speaker is engaged in many topics in both surface water and groundwater resources. But I want to particularly note that he was involved in the Sustainable Groundwater Workshop hosted earlier this year in Sacramento at the Cal EPA building, where we saw the panelists speak to high-ranking members of the Department of Water Resources, Cal EPA. I believe all five members of the State Water Board were on that. Steve's giving me the nod. So without further ado, I give you the General Manager of the Sonoma County Water Agency, Mr. Grant Davis.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. Appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here with you today, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to go into a bit more detail about the status of groundwater planning in the region. I want to also commend Matt and the staff for the great working relationship that we've developed over the years. And you as board members play a critical role in the health of this ecosystem and our stewardship just as that. Also want to just briefly, before jumping into formal comments, recognize Warner Chabot, who was here earlier. A terrific, wonderful selection for SFEI, and I think is going to help us bring additional resources and expertise into this region. It'll help us in the long run. But I do think he got credit for one thing that maybe is not entirely all his doing. We have Dr. Tracy Ishikawa here, who's a 23-year veteran from USGS, and I think if anybody brought the rain, it was probably Tracy. So that said, in recognizing the important connection between surface water and groundwater resources and the role that groundwater plays in providing water supply resiliency, the Water Agency, along with our partners, have been leaders in studying and managing the region's groundwater resources. About 15 years ago, the Water Agency initiated a partnership with the USGS to systematically assess the county's larger and more developed groundwater basins. The first two of these studies were completed in 2006, and those were in the Alexander Valley and the Sonoma Valley. And I'm also pleased to report that just earlier this year, after significant work, we've launched, along with USGS and the city of Petaluma, a new effort to study the Petaluma Valley watershed. So those are the groundwater basins that are in play. There are others, but those are the four primary ones that we're going to be needing to do additional work. The Santa Rosa Plain study, which Dr. Nishikawa will be describing here in a moment, it was a multi-year effort that was completed earlier this year and included the development of a state-of-the-art computer model of surface water and groundwater that will be a key asset as we plan to meet our current and future water challenges. Since groundwater is a resource that is shared by many different users and also provides environmental benefits to local streams and wetlands and ecosystems that are supported by those features, we believe that the best way to address these challenges is through planning at the local level. And fortunately, state legislation also recognized that, but it does put the onus on us here to respond and do it intelligently. So beginning in Sonoma Valley in 2007, and more recently in the Santa Rosa Plain, the Water Agency has been leading local planning efforts through a collaborative process that was facilitated by the Center for Collaborative Policy, which do exceptional work, and I hope to keep bringing them in more issues like this and further complex process exceptional. We also include a diverse array of local stakeholders and partners who understand our water resources best. And Marcus Prada, who's here to my right, is our hydrologist, who has just been doing a terrific job of leading up these efforts, and we're lucky to have his expertise in the region. As a local, he also has a real dedicated awareness of the needs. So we've got good leadership, and he's going to describe the process for developing the groundwater management plan in the Santa Rosa Plain. But briefly, as you can see there, the five benefits that we're looking at as we approach this are, of course, increasing the general public awareness of groundwater, and then increasing the coordination amongst the stakeholders. And as was mentioned earlier, the need to improve the monitoring and the management of the resource. Obviously, this is going to be helping us increasing funding opportunities. As was mentioned, Prop 1 being passed by the voters now provides the region, and we're well poised to secure additional funding for these types of efforts. And then lastly, with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which Jeremiah described briefly, we have a terrific challenge ahead of us, which is how best to structure the governance and make sure that the science leads the decision-making process so that we're adequately looking at surface and groundwater in a more coordinated way. So with that, I'm going to pass the next part of this presentation on to Dr. Nishikawa. As I said, he's a 24-year veteran and one that is, I can guarantee we wouldn't be this far without his leadership. And along with Marcus, I also want to commend Jay Jaspers, who's our chief engineer and also the new director of groundwater management for us through the county. Tracy?
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. So I'll be speaking about the USGS work in the Santa Rosa Plain in terms of the characterization of the plain and a model that Grant just mentioned. So Warren got to give an overview of himself, so I get to. Okay, I'm a research hydrologist at the USGS. 24 years, really? I've been here 24 years? Okay.
I saw it on LinkedIn this morning.
Oh, God. and I received my PhD from UCLA. This is public record, right? So go Bruins. And, we're playing USC this weekend. So, and then for the North Coast folk, I also went to Humboldt State for many, many years. My expertise, well, we did that back there in the 70s, you know? And my expertise is in groundwater modeling and in water resources management. So the outline of my talk today will be giving a brief groundwater 101 overview, presenting an overview of the Santa Rosa Plain watershed hydrology and geochemistry, and an overview of the hydrologic model. All right, so this up here in the upper, let's see, does this thing have a, all right. So up here in the upper right-hand corner is the water cycle, the hydrologic cycle. So water is evaporated from the oceans, forms clouds, moves over land, it rains, it snows. Some of it runs off back to the ocean, and some of it infiltrates into the soil and recharges the groundwater system. So down here is an interesting number here, is that fresh water is about 3% of the global water. Of that, groundwater is 30% of the fresh water. So that means groundwater makes up about 1% of the global water, so not much. So the source of groundwater is basically precipitation in its various forms, rainfall, snow, etc. Again, rain's on the ground, some of it runs off, some of it's taken up by plants, some of it goes into the groundwater system. Now, some people have the misconception that there are underground rivers, groundwater is carried around by vast underground rivers. This is a very rare occasion. Happens in cavernous limestone, and I understand that it happens in lava tubes over by Shasta, but that's the exception, not the rule. In general, groundwater occurs in small pore spaces within rock and alluvium. Small pore spaces within the dirt, okay? So, whether it's in within the soil matrix or within fractured bedrock, you can see here this idea of within sand, maybe it has some more finer grain material between the larger grains, but still that's where most of the groundwater resides. Okay, another key concept is the idea of porosity. Porosity is a parameter that basically tells you how much open space is in the geologic material. So it's the volume of the voids over the total volume. So porosity values usually range from 0 to 50%. Now these open spaces can be filled with water or air or both, or if you have a pollutant, it could be water, air, and a pollutant. So the area from between land surface and where you have a mixture of air and water is called the unsaturated. Between when you have all water within the porous material, it's called the saturated zone. So rocks can have, this is pretty high tech. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, I want to thank my colleagues, Kathy Thorbjørnsen, a professor at San Diego State, from whom I stole a lot of this material. You can have a high porosity rock, but if the pores aren't connected, then the water can't flow through it. So a lot of times, like volcanic materials like that. Another concept is this idea of permeability, which you may have heard of. So permeability, it describes how interconnected the pores are. So a higher permeability will allow the water to flow much easier than a low permeability material. So, one of the key—I might have already thrown this term around here—aquifer. So it's a saturated geologic unit that can transmit significant quantities of water, and I've also seen it defined as it can be economically exploited, whatever that means. So, opposite of an aquifer is an aquitard. So an aquitard is a bed of lower permeability material, like a clay or a shale, that prevents water from flowing through it. And it's not even prevents, it retards, water can still be flow through it, but very slowly. So in this picture here, we have the unsaturated zone, right, between land surface and the water table. Okay, we have what's called an unconfined aquifer. An unconfined aquifer is not under pressure, it's that atmospheric pressure here. You have a clay aquitard in this picture, and then beneath this, what's called a confined aquifer. Confined aquifer, this water is under pressure, and I'll talk about that. Let's see here. Okay, here we go. So we already talked about the confining layer or the aquitard. So now we have a confined aquifer. So confined aquifer, you have recharge occurring over here. You have this aquitard here, and usually a basement down at the beneath it. So this water is under pressure. So if you put a well in it, into that confined system, the pressurized water would rise within the well and might even go above land surface, okay? So these wells are called artesian wells. Remember the old Olympia Brewery commercial that I stopped for, I break for artesians? Okay, that's what they're talking about. All right, so they're talking about artesian wells here. I might be dating myself on that one too. So now we've also talked a lot, or you may have heard this term bandied about, the groundwater basin. So it's basically an alluvial aquifer that's bounded by impermeable boundaries. So this picture here is the Morongo Basin down in the Mojave Desert. But it's basically surrounded by bedrock or impermeable material all the way around it. Okay, within a basin, you might have what's called subbasins, and sometimes, and these are subdivisions within a groundwater basin. So like these are all the sub-bases within the Morongo. And sometimes there's actual physical reasons that they're broken apart. Say there might be, like here, between the Warren and the Joshua Tree, there's a fault there, a series of faults. So that kind of prevents groundwater flow moving from Warren into Joshua Tree. Sometimes it's just purely political. So it has no, it could fiscal reason, it could be a political reason. All right, I just want a couple more concepts to touch on. Concept of, which is important in this area, is the concept of groundwater surface water interaction. So when you have, okay, when you have a water table higher than, okay, so here we have groundwater, it's an unconfined system. We have a river going down this way. So you have, if the water table is higher than the river, then water will flow into the river. And that's called a gaining stream. The river is gaining groundwater. In this case over here, the water table is lower than the river, so the water is flowing from the river into the groundwater system. So the river is recharging the groundwater system, and that's a losing stream. Now, in this picture, we see that the effect of pumping can have, where the pumping has lowered the water table, thereby causing it, this river may have been gaining prior to pumping, but now you start pumping, you're going to start having it losing water. All right, so in this picture, you have the concepts of recharge, discharge, and flow paths. So let's say here's the recharge area. We have water recharging into the unconfined aquifer. Again, these confining beds aren't completely impermeable. They're not like cement or concrete or something like that. The water can flow through them, albeit very slowly. And they flow into, eventually into the confined system, maybe through another confining bed and into the another confining unit. Now, you can see by this picture here, we have flow paths here, these blue lines. And these flow paths can be on the order of days to years to centuries to thousands of years. And actually, I'll show you data that we have that very, that's happening here in the Santa Rosa Plain, that situation. All right, last concept is the concept of a hydrologic budget. So here we have a simple groundwater budget. So basically, you have your inflows minus your outflows equals your change in storage. So if, let's say you had a bathtub, all right, and you fill it full of water, and then you pull the stopper out, and then you start the thing, the faucet going again. If your outflows are greater than your inflows, your water is going to flow out of your bathtub. If your inflows are greater than your outflows, then the bathtub is still going to fill up or stay steady state. So the same idea here. So here you have your inflows. It could be natural land surface percolation from precipitation. Your recharge from streams. You have flows from adjacent sub-basins, say. Outflows are your pumping, your base flow, your discharge to streams. Groundwater ET, that is uptake by plants. And your surface discharge. Maybe it's springs or something like that. And then you have your outflows to the other ones. So then you take the sum of your inflows minus your sum of your outflows, that's your change in storage. And your storage in your groundwater system is your savings account. Once you start depleting your storage, that means you're going in the red on your savings account, groundwater savings account. All right, so that was it for groundwater 101. All right, do I need a bigger hose? All right. So now I'm going to talk about the characterization report. So this just gives you an idea of the USGS personnel that were involved in working on this project or projects. The folks whose names are in yellow or gold, they wrote chapters in the various reports. So the study objectives of the characterization problem was to develop an updated assessment of hydrology and geochemistry of the Santa Rosa Plain. So we need these data just to understand the system and to help for the second bullet, develop a couple of watershed groundwater flow models for the Santa Rosa Plain watershed. I mean, the last characterization work done was done by DWR in the 1980s. So the study scope is to look at the regional hydrogeology, look at the surface water hydrology, consider the groundwater hydrology in terms of characteristics, recharge, discharge, water levels and movement, and look at the geochemistry in terms of quality, source, and So this is part of the USGS Water Cooperative Program. And so it's in, it's co-funded by the USGS California Water Science, it was co-funded by the USGS California Water Science Center, and stakeholders, and the lead agency was the Seminole County Water Agency. All right, so here's our study area. The brown line here defines the Santa Rosa Plain watershed. Now, this is kind of a modified figure. If you looked at the DWR definition of the Santa Rosa Plain watershed, it's not, it kind of cuts over the, over here. We want to include more of the groundwater basins defined by DWR. So it's slightly modified from a standard watershed. It includes the Santa Rosa Plain subbasin, the Rincon Valley subbasin, parts of the Wilson Grove Formation Highlands groundwater basin, the Kenwood groundwater basin, the Healdsburg area groundwater basin, subbasin, I should say, and the Alexander Valley groundwater subbasin. In all, it's 167,400 acres. All right, so we've talked about, okay, we know that the water is in this permeable material in the dirt, basically. The dirt has to sit on something. It sits on bedrock or basement. So we work closely with our brethren in the geologic brethren. In particular, Vicki Langenheim out of Menlo Park used gravity data and aeromagnetic data to define the geometry of the basement complex within the Santa Rosa area. So let's see here. These are like faults. I should have, this is a little bit outdoor, I suppose. Here's the Sebastopol Fault. Here's the Rogers Creek Fault Zone, Trenton Ridge Fault. Okay, so basically what it shows is these two divots here are very deep to bedrock. The Windsor Basin here to the north is about 3,000 to 6,500 feet deep. The Cotati Basin down here to the south is 8,000 to 10,000 feet deep. And it's separated by a bedrock high, the Trenton Ridge. So on top of that, okay, we have soil or geologic material. This figure here shows the surface geology maps. That's basically what geologists can see when they're walking around. And so there's a couple main formations to point out. So we have over here to the east are the Sonoma volcanics, which dominate the uplands. And sometimes if you drill well, you're going to have high permeability. Sometimes if you drill well, you're going to have low permeability. Over to the west, is the Wilson Grove Formation. That's marine origin. That's when ocean sea levels were higher. And it's very little clay, so it's the most permeable material. There's the Petaluma Formation shown here in dark brown. That's marine and non-marine origin. It's very low permeability clays with some thin stringers of coarse material. Overall, it's the least permeable material in the basin. Lastly, are the Glen Ellen here in the kind of gold yellow here, and the Quaternary material, which is the kind of off-white color there. And those are clay-rich deposits of poorly assorted sand, silt, and gravel. But they have reasonable permeability overall. Now, previous work from the 50s, I believe, said this material is like thousands of feet deep. Our work indicates it's more on the order of hundreds of feet thick. Thousands of feet thick. It's more on the order of hundreds of feet thick. Okay, I already kind of mentioned some of these faults here. Faults can be important in terms of affecting groundwater flow. We have the Sebastopol Fault, this unnamed fault, another unnamed fault, the Rogers Creek Fault Zone. Let's see here, what's the Bennett Valley Fault Zone, the Mockman Fault Zone, and other fault zones up in the mountains. These two faults were just recently identified by McLaughlin in 2008. So now I'm going to show you a cartoon cross-section here on this BB prime. All right, so couple things to point out here. Again, the relatively thin Glen Ellen Quaternary material here in gold on the top. We have the Wilson Grove Formation on the west, interfingering into the Petaluma Formation. We have the Sonoma Volcanics dipping in underneath the Petaluma Formation on the east side over here. And the Petaluma Formation is very, very thick. So Emily Taylor and Don Sweetkind, geologists out of our Denver office, looked at 2,700 driller's logs. So driller's logs is when they drill a well and they say, okay, here's what kind of material I ran into, so many feet, silty sand, clays, that kind of thing. And they use these data to define the lithology or the texture of the material that they ran into. So if you go west to east, you have the kind of fine grained sands over here in the Wilson Grove. You have some sands and clays up here in the Glen Ellen Quaternary material. Really clay, there's all the clays here in blue, and here in the Petaluma Formation, and then you have the Sonoma Volcanics, the pinks up here in the uplands to the east. All right, there's three main streams draining the Santa Rosa Plain, the Marquess Creek, Santa Rosa Creek, and Laguna de Santa Rosa. There's 15 USGS stream gauges on the main channels and on tributaries. All right, so the top figure here, the bottom figure here shows total stream flow at the various stream gauges within the Santa Rosa Plain. Notice it goes from 1999 to 2010 down here. Okay, this figure here shows a combination of nearby stream gauges, say Napa, two on Napa River, one in Sonoma Creek, and a couple from the Santa Rosa Plain. This one goes from 1930 to 2010. So basically the reason I showed this, to show you that the data sets from the Santa Rosa Plain watershed are really short. I mean, on the order of maybe 2 to 5 years, maybe the longest is 10 years, but very, very short. All right, for groundwater recharge, we talked about that in the groundwater 101. We have infiltration of precipitation of the primary source and infiltration from streams. Minor sources of groundwater are groundwater underflow from neighboring sub-basins, and then septic tanks, leaky pipes, irrigation return flow, and frost protection return flow also make up minor sources of groundwater. Primary discharges are base flow, that's water, groundwater discharging into streams, and pumping. From 1976 to 2010, municipal pumping range from 3,900 to 10,000 acre feet a year. This is all reported data. For rural, which we define to be a combination domestic, small domestic pumping and agricultural pumping, this is unreported, so this was estimated, range from 26,000 to 44,000 acre feet a year. Another primary discharge is evapotranspiration, that is water taken up by plants. Minor discharges are springs and underflow to other neighboring groundwater basins. Alright, so this figure, by the way, if you don't like it, it's Marcus Trotter's fault. If you do like it, it's mine. So if we look, this figure basically is a cartoon showing the water levels, groundwater levels in 1951. So there's a lack of data prior to 1950, so this is about as close to what you might call pre-development as you're going to get. Okay, pre-development is prior to any kind of pumping, any kind of exploitation of the groundwater system. So the ideas here is that you can see over here the color bar. So the water levels are lower over here, they're higher over here. Okay, I think I forgot to mention that water flows downhill. And my groundwater 101 remarks, water flows downhill. All right, so with water flowing down here, it moves, basically is flowing east to west. I mean, there's a little bit of water going from the Wilson Grove Highlands toward, and it's all flowing toward the Laguna de Santa Rosa, which is the main outflow. And then on the, over here, east of the Rogers Creek Fault Zone, the Santa Rosa Creek, which is flowing right in here, is gaining groundwater, as gaining groundwater. figure is from 1990. Okay, there's been an increase in groundwater pumpage through the 80s and 90s. You can see that you have lower groundwater levels here down the Cotati Roner Park area, maybe a little divot right over here. And still, water in general still flowing east to west. You still have these pumping depressions that occurred in the south part of the basin. All right, in 2007, groundwater pumping had reduced. There was a reduction in groundwater pumping in the Roner Park Cotati area. And so you can see that water levels are recovered, still have a little bit of a divot here, but water still in general flowing east to west. And water still, the Sonoma Creek is still gaining water over here east of the fault zone. So another tool that we use to characterize the system is water quality. We use surface water quality, sampled at 15 sites and two springs. And we also sampled or compiled data from 162 sites. So water quality data collection efforts included using historic data. The surface water data were hit or miss from DWR and USGS. Groundwater quality data was available from DWR. Okay, I know it's not DPH anymore, but DPH and USGS. More recent data collection efforts were performed by the USGS. And sometimes if, say, a city was drilling a well or some of that, we piggybacked on top of the consultant and collected additional samples or something. Okay, so some of the data types of data we collected were major ions, including the cations and anions shown here. These help define the water type. We also sampled for or analyzed for constituents of potential concern. Stable isotopes of water, oxygen 18, hydrogen 2. These help to infer the sources of recharge. And lastly, we did age gating using tritium and carbon 14. So major ion results indicated that the faults limit groundwater flow, specifically the Rogers Creek Fault Zone, the Sebastopol Fault, and that unnamed fault that was just east of the Sebastopol Fault all limit groundwater flow. In addition, the major ion data indicate that the clay in the Petaluma Formation limits vertical flow between where the Wilson Grove interfingers with the overlying Petaluma. So there's it inhibits vertical flow of water. Okay, constituents of potential concern. So these are all the constituents we sampled for or analyzed for. The numbers on the right are the MCLs or the secondary MCLs or the health-based notification levels. This percentage is the number of wells that exceeded those limits. So you can see down here, say most are relatively low. Iron, 43% of wells are greater than 300 micrograms. And manganese, 73% of the wells were greater than 50 micrograms. Steel isotope data. The mountains and valleys to the east were recharged by precipitation falling at higher elevations. The Wilson Grove to the west was recharged by precipitation falling on the lower elevations of the Mendocino Mountains. The Mendocinos were lower elevation than the mountains to the east, and then that's spaced out with the Mayaquinas. The San Rosa Plain is recharged by a mixture of waters as from the sides as well as direct precipitation. All right, so Jeremiah didn't want me to use this figure, but it's easier than saying it. So basically what you want to see is this well 102 here, the water is 10,000 to 27,000 years old. This well over here, water from these wells over here on W33 and W34 are 14,000 and 34,000 years old. All right, I'm cutting to the chase here. And so that indicates that this water takes a very long flow path across So we use all these data, all the water quality, the hydrogeology, everything to develop a conceptual model of the system. So I think we already said this, precipitation is a major source of recharge. Most of it occurs in the mountains with some occurring on the plain. All right, so you have most of it going here, but some of it is occurring on the plain. And then some of the mountain precipitation probably runs off, contributing to stream flow, and then recharges the system as it enters the plain. The Marquess Creek, Santa Rosa Creek, and Laguna de Santa Rosa and their tributaries drain the Santa Rosa Plain watershed. As we said previously, the Santa Rosa Creek gains groundwater based on water level data east of the Rogers Creek Fault Zone. The water is contained in four formations, the Wilson Grove and Sonoma Volcanic Inner Finger with a Petaluma Formation into the Santa Rosa Plain. This is just a cartoon. And then, which can be as much as 10,000 feet deep, and underlain by bedrock in the, say, in the Cotati Basin. As we stated earlier, under various conditions, groundwater flows from east to west, exchanging water with creeks as it goes along in the shallower ones. And then again, Rogers Creek Fault Zone, the Sebastopol Fault, and this unnamed fault are barriers to groundwater flow. Although we collected lots of data, there still are data gaps. Okay, what we really lacked were depth-dependent data. The data we collected were from production wells, which is basically an integrated sample. So what we really needed is to have depth-dependent, so we knew what was going on at various places within the aquifer system. Main outflows from the groundwater system is pumpage, ag, and domestic. That's unreported. We need a better way of either having it reported or having it better methods of estimating those data. Any questions?
Tracy, can I ask you a question? I'm over on the Sevastopol side of the basin, and I'm curious about the connectivity of the Wilson Grove Highlands to the Laguna itself, the center of the plain, I should say. You mentioned in here that the Sebastopol Fault could be impeding groundwater flow and connectivity between that. Do you have any estimate of how continuous that is or at what depth that occurs?
I don't have an estimate on the, when you say kind of, how long along the north, on the north south way or depth wise?
Depth-wise?
Because the data we have are limited. It's based on these bulk samples we collected. So I would say that we're speaking in generalities here.
By the way, I wanted to thank you for updating from Bulletin 118. 118 was fine, but this is so far above and beyond, it's awesome.
Thank you.
Were you serious about questions?
Sure. I can do it. I mean, what do you want? You want to do it later or you want to do it now?
Let's go. I was going to ask you to back up to the first slide where you showed age of water. No, too far.
Yeah.
So just to make sure that I'm understanding, when we talk age of water, that is water that has been in the system since the last glacial period, if we're talking 11 to 27,000 years?
Yes.
And that's does it take that long for that water to percolate to that depth, or that's how long that water has been sitting at that depth?
Well, that's how old the water is. I mean, if you look at these, if you look at these wells over here, and I kind of skipped over some of this stuff, but these wells here, like that water is 8 to 10,000 years old. So you have water flowing out of the mountains into the toward this well 102, so it's been there for that long.
It's been there, but that doesn't, so in the event that the aquifer should be depleted, does it take 10,000 years to recharge it?
Could.
Thank you.
Under natural conditions, I mean, if you go in and start injecting water or something like that, then obviously it's a different problem.
Asking that question in a different way, aside from the length of time that it would take discharge the water, wouldn't the effect of increased infiltration and input into the system be felt at all locations within the basin in terms of, say, depth of water or some other measure of storage capacity?
Well, I mean, recharge is usually a pressure response, right? So you're not going to have that. If you put, put a pond here, a recharge pond over here, you wouldn't necessarily see that molecule of water within, I mean, it'd take years or longer to move west across the basin. So it's, but you might see a pressure response relatively quickly. That's why you
therefore an increased storage capacity even at the far side of the basin.
Increased storage capacity.
Well,
I mean,
looking at the system as a whole to determine whether storage capacity has increased or decreased.
So, like the numbers on, I'll show some storage numbers here in a minute here. That's like on an average over the entire basin, right? So it's not location specific. If you look at those water level contours where you had the divots of low water levels in the south part of the basin, you'd have greater storage capacity there than maybe where water levels hadn't been reduced on the north part of the basin. So it's kind of a location dependent problem. So the numbers I'm going to present are kind of an overall average across the entire watershed. Does that answer the question?
Well, it does speak to the difference between 10,000 years for a recharge at a particular location and a response to a change in withdrawal rates or...
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, if you start pumping, like I said, I mean, if you're pumping there in the Cotati, it's kind of a localized response. I think that's what you're asking.
Well, I'm thinking that pumping in Chicago, wouldn't it, even though you have lowered water evident at that location, wouldn't it affect the basin as a whole also, the water availability? Would it affect water availability at all locations in the basin?
I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, you know, I guess if you look at the basin holistically, then maybe, yes. I mean, you're saying, okay, we don't want to have that drawdown in Cotati as a basin, as an entire watershed. Therefore, it's going to change with how much we can pump out of the entire watershed. Okay. If you look at it by, say, the last Cotati problem, look up here in Windsor, we don't have any drawdown problems, then that's another way of looking. So it depends on if you're looking at holistically within over the entire basin or not, I guess.
Well, thank you. It is a complex question and a complex answer.
Tracy, I think what occasions Greg's question is probably the one that I have too. It's really the question of drawdown. That concerns anybody as a member of the public. That water may never be pumped, correct? What we're really doing is pumping from some level above that. We're never gonna deplete it. If you do, you've got subsidence and you've got all kinds of troubles like that. I think the real question is the level of recharge and how much can we do? That's nice to know that there's 10,000 year water, but how much can we actually get out of this? Because as a state, I think we're looking at groundwater suddenly from the perspective of storage, that it is the new water supply, if you will, that the surface water has been tamped out. Now we're gonna go to understanding that there's all of the interconnections to it. So if you say that it's 10,000 year old water, that's a nice idea, but how much can we actually get, I think, is the real.
But just a point, though, Mr. Massey, the reason I ask is because I have firsthand knowledge of wells on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley that are 3,000 feet deep pumping 18,000-year-old water, causing the subsidence. So it can be reached, and
yeah.
And I think that's what piqued my interest. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it can be reached.
Well, if I may, Tracy, any of the members of the panel can feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but what I took from the first presentation that the GS did, and this is from Tracy and other staff that were came along, similar questions came up from the Basin Advisory Panel. And if I'm correct in observing, that the statement was made, we are not really in any threat to overdraft this aquifer on the supply side of things. We'll give you some more information as we move along through the presentation that's coming up here. And then one of the things that I think we should keep in mind, though, is what level of drawdown do we get to the point to where that may adversely affect our ecosystems? So that was really one of the big punchlines that we could emphasize on that in regards to the water budget in the basin itself.
And what Greg is saying is contradicting what you're saying, Tracy.
Well,
you said that water flows downhill. And in the San Joaquin, water flows money.
Well, it's not just the San Joaquin. That's why I said like an aquifer is defined by, you know, what can be economically pumped or exploited or extracted or whatever the term it might be. And so if you want the water bad enough, then you'll drill 3,000 feet, right? If you want the water bad enough, you'll drill 5,000 feet. You'll treat that brackish water, or you'll do something to make it drinkable. I think that what you're getting at is what's called safe yield, or the new term is sustainable yield. Yeah, I'm old school with safe yield. And sustainable yield is kind of one man's sustainable yield is another man's. You're ruining the environment, or you're not doing it enough. We can take more, and it's really up to the local stakeholders to define that sustainable yield. What they're willing to say, we want that water pattern to let every creek dry up, or we don't want to pump any because we don't want any of these creeks to dry up. So. It really comes down to what the local stakeholders are willing to accept or not accept. Now I forgot what I was going to say, so now I'm really going to wing it here. All right. So now I'm going to talk about the coupled the watershed model, the hydrologic model of the Santa Rosa Plain. Watershed. And so I've already used the term model, and so I like this slide because it's kind of like the caveat emperor, right? So so what a model is, it doesn't matter if it's a groundwater model or it's a model of an airplane. It's a simplification or abstract representation of the real system. All right. It's a supplemental water management tool. It's a computer program used to simulate and predict, in this case, hydrologic and aquifer conditions. Could be used to simulate how an airplane flies. Approximations of water transfer between surface and subsurface, and it's a tool to estimate the water budget. A model is not a unique solution. It's not the only true and absolute answer. It's no way certain in what is simulated or predicted, and doesn't replace actual data. All right, so the Santa Rosa Plain hydrologic model was developed using the USGS model GS Flow to better understand and to help manage the hydrologic or water resources in the Santa Rosa Plain watershed. GS Flow is an integrated groundwater and surface water model that consists of two components: a watershed component, which is PRMS. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's another USGS code, which is a watershed, and the groundwater component, which is MODFLOW NEW. All right, so basically it addresses almost all aspects of the hydrologic cycle that we talked about except for precipitation. Okay, we have to take precipitation as an input, as a driver. There's other drivers such as air temperature and some other things like that. But you can see that it addresses soil water, the unsaturated zone, the saturated zone, ET, evapotranspiration of water by plants, stream flow, many, many different components of the hydrologic cycle. All right, so one of the simplifying things that we have to do with the model is discretize space and time. And because we can't estimate water levels everywhere in space, it's infinite. So we made a cell size, a mesh of 660 feet by 660 feet. So we estimated the water levels at the center of every one of those little squares. There's 8 vertical layers. The thickness ranges, you can see here, in this little table here, and this cross section here just shows how the vertical layering worked. So the colored squares here are where the groundwater can talk to the other sub-basins, all right? And where it's brown is what's called a no flow. It's where there's bedrock, so there's no water flowing in or out of the system. So inputs to the watershed component are precipitation. Now here's some of the data we're talking about. Air temperature, soils data, vegetation data, and land use, including percent impervious area. So the groundwater component, inputs include pumpage, reclaimed water, and initial estimates of aquifer properties, I'll call it permeability, that we talked about earlier. Boundary condition stuff, so for water to flow in and out to other sub-basins. Stream bed properties, so you can see how much the stream water talks to the groundwater. And then saturated zone properties. So here's an idea of the stream network that we simulated. So we simulated named first order streams. And then we can also, what's a nice thing about the model is that I think in that one figure, where the stream bed is disconnected from the groundwater, there's an unsaturated zone between the stream bed and the groundwater system, and we can simulate that unsaturated zone. So pumping is really an important stress on the system. So we have 70 public supply wells shown in blue. Right there, it's kind of all mixed in there. All the pink well circles are what we define as rural wells. Again, that's a combination of domestic and agricultural wells. So we have to basically make the model fit our observed data. That's called the calibration process. There's various things that we can tweak within the system or within the model, but we use what's called a trial and error approach and trying to match stream flow and heads. We simulated, we used 12 USGS stream gauges and heads measured at 83 wells. So here's an idea of a stream flow, simulated and measured stream flow. In general, for all the stream flow stream gauges, we had a fair to excellent model fit. This is the Marquess Creek at Mirabel. That's where Marquess Creek flows out of the basin toward the Russian River. You can see basically, I gotta put my glasses on again. All right, so the aqua color is the measured data and the black lines are the simulated. You can see basically we did a pretty good job of matching the observed data. Where we didn't do such a great job is where we had the really low flows down here. So here's this is similar to the other figure I showed earlier. So here's a simulated and measured water levels. Okay, here's the water levels here in the white lines, the measured data, and here's the simulated water levels. We have the same flow direction. We have the gaining streams up here, so we have a pretty good fit for water levels. All right, let's see here. All right, so here's one of the first things we got out of the model as a budget. We talked about, we showed the budget figure in generalities in the groundwater 101 section. So here we have average from 76 to 2010. Basically, we have 80,600 acre feet a year coming in, about 83,900 acre feet going out. You have slight withdrawal from your savings account of about 3,300 acre feet on average. So What that indicates is that the savings account is contributing to roughly about 10% of the groundwater pump from the system. Okay, just in, to put in perspective, that's not too bad. I work a lot in the Mojave Desert. There, you can have 90% or more is from your from the groundwater savings account. All right, so this figure shows the net flux for an average year. Net flux is the sum of inflows and outflows at the water table. So cool colors indicate groundwater recharge, and hot colors indicate groundwater discharge. So you can see that most of the flux, in or out, is happening along the streams. Okay. In fact, on average, over half the net recharge is occurring in streams, and more than 90% of the net discharge, groundwater discharge, is happening in streams. So streams are very important. So this figure shows the effect of pumping on stream flow. So we did two simulations, here with pumping and without pumping, and we looked at the percent change in stream flow due to pumping. So you can see that it ranges from, you know, less than 1 to about 16 to 50%. So you can see that in some of these channels, say on the Laguna, maybe on the Copeland Creek and some other ones, you had pretty big reduction percentage wise. This figure shows on the top, total pumping as it varies by year. And on the bottom, you have cumulative net stream leakage. Okay, that's stream recharge minus stream discharge. And you have cumulative groundwater storage. This is the stream leakage, and this is the groundwater storage, sorry. So you can see that the stream leakage, you can hardly see it. There's little bands right here. The little bands indicate wet years, then the white bands are dry years. All right, so you can see there's a little bit of fluctuation in the streams leakage with wet and dry, but basically it increased with pumpage. See here that there was more, the groundwater storage varied more with climate and therefore with pumping, okay? But in general, the cumulative groundwater, still the storage still was depleted. All right. Last thing I want to show is some future climate scenarios. We looked at four climate scenarios and compared it to historical climate baseline period of water years 81 to 2010. So for this talk, I'm just going to present some model runs without pumping to show the effect of only climate on a hydrologic system. But we did do, if you look, I know you're going to run home and download the report and, you know, read it tonight. And if, when you do, you'll see that we did pumping scenarios too. So so basically there's these two CO2 scenarios, CO2 loading scenarios. The A2 is a medium high emission CO2 scenario, and the B1 is a low emission CO2 scenario. The G and the P are different models that were used. G is Goddard, and I can't remember what P stands for. So you can basically look from this table, you can see that the GA2 resulted in the driest in terms of precipitation and the warmest in terms of air temperature. And the PB1 is the wettest and the coolest. So in terms of precipitation, you see that all are variable. Okay, so here's in black, here's our historic data, and then you go into the future. You see that that's more variable than the historic, and the solid line here is the 10-year moving average. And there's a decline in precipitation in later years in precip. Here's your average temperature. All right, they all vary a bit, but they all increase with time. All right, so here's the effect of future climate on stream flow. This is total stream flow. Again, the black dots and lines are historic, and then these are simulated to the right. So, in general, stream flow is much more variable in all scenarios, and it declines at the end We have a net decline streamboat in all scenarios except for PA2. So these are, I want to stress again, these are without any pumping. If you had more, if you had pumping in the scenario, then you can have, you could exacerbate the effects. All right, last slide is shows the effect of future climate on recharge. So this shows the difference in recharge in 2070 to 2099 versus 1981 to 2010. Okay, again, GA2 is the driest, PB1 is the wettest. So you see here that, okay, so the hotter the color, you're getting a decrease in recharge, the hotter the color decrease, cooler color increase. So you can see over here in GA2, you have quite a large area of decrease in recharge. Over here, as you go wetter, you still have areas of maybe not as bad decrease, and you have maybe more areas of a slight increase. All right, so that's enough of the fire hose. If you want to rush out and clog up the Wi-Fi here, you can download the reports. And the California Water Science Center webpage is on the bottom. Any questions?
How about we do this, Tracy? How about we take a 10-minute break? We'll come back and let Marcus go, and then take up all the questions at the end.
Perfect.
That'll work. All right, we'll be back here at 10 till. I want to acknowledge that John Corbett, our chair, has come in, so I'm going to hand it off to John and let it go.
Okay. So we'll turn it over to you.
Great, thank you. Thanks for having me. And as Grant mentioned, my name is Marcus Trotta. I'm a hydrogeologist with the Sonoma County Water Agency. I've been working with the agency for a little over 6 years now, and I primarily work on groundwater management initiatives here in the Santa Rosa Plain, as well as in Sonoma Valley, as well as working with Tracy and doing our regional groundwater studies in many of the basins in the county, and also am involved in managing some of our enhanced recharge studies that I'll describe briefly during this presentation. So really what I wanted to do is provide you an overview of kind of the process, the content, and then what we're looking to do in terms of implementation of this groundwater management plan that we've just completed development of here in the Santa Rosa Plain Groundwater Basin. As Grant had mentioned, having a groundwater management plan in place really provides a lot of benefits to the region and really positions us really well in terms of meeting the new state requirements for groundwater management that just are going to go into effect this coming January. Additionally, as we learned from Tracy, the region overall is experiencing an imbalance in terms of the amount of water that's flowing into the basin versus the amount of water that's flowing out, which could certainly be exacerbated by future climate change conditions. And this imbalance can lower groundwater levels, has the potential to reduce stream flows, and potentially affect ecosystems. So our local response, as Grant has mentioned, the Water Agency has led the development to proactively and voluntarily develop non-regulatory groundwater management plans. We've done this through a collaborative, stakeholder-driven process, utilizing the services of the Center for Collaborative Policy, which is provided for a very robust stakeholder engagement program. And really, moving forward, the success of implementing this plan is really going to rely on the continued participation of the local stakeholders in the region. This slide just provides kind of some of the background and overall timeline of our process for developing the groundwater management plan. And you can see it's really been done in a pretty methodical manner over about a 5-year period. And we've had lots of public outreach and steps along the way to reach out, share, and solicit information from the public. Started with a stakeholder assessment back in 2009, conducted by the Center for Collaborative Policy, where they went out and interviewed about 55 different people here in the Santa Rosa Plain that had varied interests in groundwater. And that assessment found that they recommended that we conduct some additional outreach, and so we formed a steering committee that met for about a year, that also engaged in doing some public outreach. We had three public forums, evening public forums that were very well attended. That steering committee came back and recommended that we proceed with developing a voluntary groundwater management plan. There's different forms of groundwater management that can be done throughout the state. And for this basin, having this voluntary non-regulatory plan was what was recommended by this advisory committee. In December 2011, we convened a basin advisory panel I'll show in the next couple slides, represents about 30 stakeholders here in the basin with varied interest in groundwater. That basin advisory panel met about 23 times between December 2011 and August 2014 to develop this groundwater management plan. Was supported by a technical advisory committee as well. Tracy publishes reports in July of 2013 and April 2014, and the data from those reports really form the scientific foundation and backbone behind the groundwater management plan itself. We held four public evening forums in May of 2014. They're attended by over 200 people throughout the basin. And then in August of this year, the Basin Advisory Panel recommended the groundwater management plan for adoption by our board, the Water Agency's Board of Directors. The Basin Advisory Panel selected the Water Agency to be the lead agency for the groundwater management plan. And just this past October, on October 7th, our board adopted the groundwater management plan. So the Basin Advisory Panel, as I mentioned, made up of a vast array of local stakeholders from the agricultural community, business development community, environmental organizations were well represented at the table. Members of the general public, including rural well owners, as Tracy mentioned, rural domestic well owners are a large user of groundwater in our basin, and there's not necessarily a rural well owner organization. So getting the participation and input from those groups is really important. Governmental agencies, all the cities and larger water districts participated in the development of the plan and also helped fund the plan. Other groundwater users, natural resource management, the Laguna de Santa Rosa, the local resource conservation districts were also involved. We had the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria at the table, as well as other local water companies. This shows the overall management structure for the development of the plan and also how the plan will be managed moving forward. The Basin Advisory Panel is really the entity that guides the implementation of the plan and makes recommendations on decisions that the Water Agency's board would ultimately decide on. If there's any updates to the plan or any major decisions to the plan, those would go to our board. We would implement the plan along with our other jurisdictional partners. That includes helping to fund the plan. The Basin Advisory Panel will be continued to be supported by a technical advisory committee made up of technical experts, other hydrogeologists, resource managers that meet to make recommendations to the Basin Advisory Panel. The goal of the plan is to locally manage and protect groundwater resources by a balanced group of stakeholders through non-regulatory measures to support all beneficial uses, including human agricultural ecosystems in an environmentally sound, economical, and equitable manner for present and future generations. Some of the primary elements that are within the plan are our water resources section, basically describing the information and data that Tracy provided you a little while ago. Goals and objectives to manage the groundwater basins. Management components to implement those goals and objectives and accomplish those goals and objectives, and then an implementation plan that prioritizes the recommended actions for the plan. So there's six primary management components that are included in the plan. Continued stakeholder involvement, meetings with the Basin Advisory Panel, as well as continued continued opportunities for public forums and getting the information out through our website and other media outlets. Monitoring program and additional modeling is really one of the cores of the plan itself. Provides a foundation for tracking conditions into the future, monitoring progress and making decisions. And some of those monitoring elements include measuring groundwater levels and improving our network of groundwater level measurements in the basin is really one key. It's one of the data gaps that Tracy had mentioned is our the need for improved groundwater level monitoring. Groundwater quality monitoring, that's primarily collecting information from existing groundwater quality monitoring programs so that we can track groundwater quality in the basin over time. You're sure well aware that just as important as the quantity of groundwater, the quality of your groundwater resource is also critically important to having a sustainable groundwater resource. Inelastic land surface subsidence is something that's required to be monitored under a groundwater management plan that's looking for the potential for subsidence of the ground surface due to groundwater pumping. Something that's happening right now in the Central Valley to a very large degree. Monitoring for surface water and groundwater interaction. Tracy, you talked about the importance of the connection between our streams and groundwater resources. So having some programs in place to monitor that and track that over time. Hydrometeorological monitoring, improving our understanding of precipitation throughout the region, where it occurs, what the variability is. And for all that, we'll be establishing monitoring protocols, data management system, and then prioritizing data needs. Another management component is groundwater protection, maintaining the quantity and quality of groundwater, and that's an area where we really see coordinating closely with the regional board. The protection of groundwater recharge areas is included under that component. Other components are to increase the conservation and efficiency of groundwater use to reduce the stresses and overall demand for groundwater in the basin. Increasing groundwater recharge, finding opportunities where we can enhance natural groundwater recharge through stormwater infiltration, or looking at potentially doing groundwater banking, utilizing wintertime Russian river water. And I'll describe both of those programs in a little more detail. Increasing water reuse, where appropriate and responsible, utilizing recycled water for irrigation to offset groundwater demands in the basin. And then integrated groundwater management, just continuing to foster collaboration with existing organizations, such as the regional board and others, on climate change planning and other multiple benefit actions. Land use planning, improving the coordination between water resource managers and land use planners is a key initiative within the plan. So I'll just highlight a couple of the initiatives that fall under the enhanced recharge component. This is groundwater banking, and specifically looking at aquifer storage and recovery. And so we've already conducted a preliminary feasibility study with some of our partners in the region to look at the potential for utilizing wintertime Russian River water when it's available, conveying that through our transmission system and storing it in the groundwater basin. We've conducted that study in both the Santa Rosa Plain and, oops, that was a mistake. Where's the pointer? Oh, there it is. So conceptually, it's again, taking this Russian River water, sending it through our transmission system, and recharging it through wells for storage in aquifers, having that water available during the summertime to help meet peak demands, or keep it in the aquifer for a longer periods to help us get us through drought periods like we're experiencing now. And for this program, we've already brought some information to your staff and shared some results of the study, and look forward to continuing to work with your staff in terms of permitting a pilot project, which is really the next step in this type of project, is to conduct a small-scale pilot study to really look closely at the potential interaction between the surface water, the drinking water that we'd be recharging with the native groundwater and aquifer system to see what the water quality changes would be. The other initiative that we're involved in is looking at opportunities for improving stormwater management and also recharging our groundwater basins. And we've conducted scoping studies in three watersheds where the water agency has flood control responsibilities. So this is the Laguna de Santa Rosa watershed, Santa Rosa Plain Groundwater Basin, in addition to Sonoma Valley and Petaluma Valley. And it's really looking at a vast array of project concepts. It could include floodplain expansion, creek daylighting projects, detention or retention basins that are located in areas with soils that are permeable enough where that stormwater can also be infiltrating and recharging our groundwater basin. We've got a project here in this region that we got some grant funding for that we're in the basis of design phase on the Copeland Creek, just east of Verona Park, where we're looking at whether we can design such a detention basin that can also provide some recharge function as well. And so we're really excited about seeing that project move forward. So some of the areas where we see some of the involvement and coordination with the regional board staff, again, includes permitting or oversight for specific projects that are recommended in the plan. I mentioned the aquifer storage recovery and the stormwater recharge projects. Recycled water projects also fall under that category. And then continued coordination and information sharing on other related programs, groundwater quality protection, salt nutrient management planning, and because surface water and groundwater resources are so closely connected, TMDL development and implementation, as well as ecosystem restoration and stream maintenance activities. So our next steps in terms of the groundwater management plan are to kick off the implementation, which will start at the beginning part of this coming year, 2015. For the first 2 years, we'll primarily be working on developing our monitoring program for all of those components that I had mentioned, establishing the networks, developing the monitoring protocols, and really getting the monitoring off the ground. We'll also be performing some additional computer simulations. Tracy trained us on the use of his model. And so we'll be taking some potential management scenarios, looking at things like stormwater infiltration, other types of alternative projects, and how those might fit together to help us sustain our groundwater resources in the basin. And then we'll be putting that information to the model to look at various alternatives. And then we'll be continuing on our stakeholder coordination, public outreach. In addition, as Jeremiah outlined, we have the new groundwater legislation. So we'll need to evaluate what requirements have come out of that legislation and how that's going to impact our groundwater management plan. What changes may need to be made to our groundwater management plan to comply with those new requirements. And with that, I'll take any questions.
We have one more, Marcus. Go ahead and hit the next slide and I'll wrap up. Just a few quick concluding comments to bring us all back to context and really, again, provide a great big thank you for the top shelf work that USGS has provided by Tracy and his staff, really the leadership by the Sonoma County Water Agency. And I really have observed Marcus closely in this process and all the challenges that he has had to face along the way. And really, it's a great model. And it's a great thing to emulate both the science and the process here. Again, I said it in a comment when we were taking questions earlier, but I think the upshot should really focus on the fact that we're not really in a state of overdraft or a threat of overdraft for the entire basin, but that we should really pay close attention to the fact that there is a strong connection between surface water and groundwater, as we know this to be true in many of our key groundwater basins. And also keep in mind, as you'll hear a lot more of pretty soon here on the coming priorities for the basin planning unit that have to do with the basin plan water quality objectives, chemical constituents and groundwater toxicity, as well as our future movement towards further groundwater protection and assistance that this board can provide. So with that, again, a big thank you to everybody on this panel, and questions.
Any questions?
More of a comment. Thanks for all the information. I think you could have teed up my comment better than with your summary, but you know, I do see a collaborative effort coming with our staff and agency staff, particularly to optimize, or maybe an optimization exercise, where we're trying to balance our implementing recharge but maintaining our surface water objectives. So, I mean, it's clearly particularly with the priority list upcoming for the triennial review, when those are being set, clearly with we see both objectives and the clear need for both objectives, but they may be competing in some cases, and so just to be able to work together and not have one at the suffer from the other, but I think that it's a mutually achievable goal, but there's going to be a balancing act, so it'll be fun to see how that develops.
Excuse me. I'm not sure who to ask this of, but this is a tremendous effort here, and thank you guys for an education on groundwater that I don't think any of us would add any other way. Because this is going to entail the new law, etc., and it will obviously be part of this agency, no matter whether we're talking to Santa Rosa Plain or we're talking Tule Lake. The Sonoma County Water Agency has always been in front of many things, and thank you very much, Grant, and the agency for that. The question really is that possible with other counties and their agencies to do this kind of work, whether it comes from USGS or internally within those counties to meet the requirements that we have under the new groundwater law? So anybody want to stick their neck out?
I hesitate to suggest that. I think it has to. I mean, that many would have felt that the groundwater legislation probably didn't have a chance of coming into law without the drought. I think the multiple year drought certainly changed the dynamic. There are some areas, certainly in the adjudicated basins, that lend themselves well to this type of management. The real question statewide right now is there some other hybrid process that you can achieve without going through an entire adjudication? That is a extremely long process, and one that few regions really are equipped to go through. And so I would hope, and we currently are viewed in this region with Marcus and Jay and the community's efforts ahead of the curve, and it remains to be seen. I think they are really looking to this region to see how we fare, because we've been out with the plans, we've had it facilitated, and we're not adjudicated, and as a result, our success then would lead to other areas probably coming along. During the development of the legislation, they extended the timeline somewhat, recognizing this is a tall order. So while some would have liked to have seen this done in a couple of years, the reality is they put on another decade of sorts for actual implementation. And I think that was an important step, because it's significant enough that we're actually addressing groundwater and its significance and its importance to the water supply for California. But I think the short answer to that is various regions are going to have to make those connections, and my hope would be that we can find a way to do this as much as an involuntary way as possible. I think the one highlight I would put here, that Marcus said it twice, is that we developed voluntary management structures for groundwater management, voluntary stakeholder-driven processes that were egalitarian and had the right governance structure. The new law adds a couple of provisions that could dramatically alter that approach. One is it provides for a regulatory authority to occur. And whenever you do that, as you well know, that changes the dynamic, and it has a different set of circumstances for noncompliance. And then the second one would be the revenue opportunity that are going to be required, the self-assessments to make this possible. And up until now, that had not been thoroughly thought through. So those are two areas that we ourselves are going to have to go through, and I would imagine any other area of the state are going to encounter as well.
Thank you.
Board Member
Mr. Chair. Thank you all for a thorough and thoughtful presentation. I really appreciate it. I wanted to share with you what resonated with me with the copious amounts of information you shared. Though I appreciate that we are not as bad off as the Mojave Desert in our overdraft of groundwater, the Mojave Desert doesn't have salmonids. And so that doesn't give me comfort to know that we're doing a pretty good job, but we're still in the red. And the fact that what you shared with us was an average over a great period of time, a dewatered stream, a fish dies in 4 minutes, and at that point, I don't think they care about the arithmetic mean of a data set. So we're dealing with critical times on some of these small order streams that you showed that, you know, maybe a 50% chance of dewatering, and it's a seasonal critical component. The other challenge I think you have, Grant, is the image of the hundreds of dots of wells out there, which I think reminds us that California water policy and approach was formed under a form of government that can only be referred to as an adhocracy. There's no rhyme or reason how all of this came to be today. And I think the challenge for you is to try and address the groundwater issue, recognizing, though, that on the North Coast, surface water is equally important for the beneficial uses of humans and non-humans. So, again, I really do appreciate what you shared with us, but models and arithmetic means are just that, and we need to make sure that folks are on the ground and paying attention to the seasonality of stream flow and the relationship of that seasonality to components of that stream. But thank you very much. Again, I just wanted to share with you what resonated with me.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I, for one, want to thank the USGS for putting the credibility to, again, out there to get us way advanced on a model of what's actually potentially happening here and what could happen in the future. At the same time, the Water Agency, thank you for getting us 5 years ahead of the curve. I think, I would rather be in that stance than to be sitting here and trying to figure out how we're going to do this. At the same time, I would tell you that there's not hundreds of dots. I've heard that in the Santa Rosa area or the Santa Rosa Plain that there's somewhere between 20 and 40,000 domestic wells. I don't know if that's fact or fiction. I know I have one of them. I'm part of the problem again. But let me ask, I'm interested, Sonoma Valley went first. Would you be so kind as to share some lessons learned out of Sonoma Valley? I mean, you have started the actual process over there. So what's the process that you've encountered over there on the microcosm, at least a smaller version of what you may face here?
Yeah, so in Sonoma Valley, I didn't really present on it today, but we went through a similar process, and it really kind of formed the model for the groundwater management planning that we recently conducted here in the Santa Rosa Plain. And there we developed a plan in, I think it was 2007. It's been successful in terms of really expanding the data collection in that area. It also followed on a USGS study. The USGS study identified a couple of areas where there were some wells with declining groundwater levels. I think we started with about 30 or 40 wells that were monitored for groundwater levels in that basin through outreach efforts. And a lot of volunteer time, actually, we were able to expand that monitoring network to about 140, 150 wells that are monitored twice a year, which has really allowed us to expand and refine our understanding of these groundwater level declines. Sonoma Valley, actually, the groundwater conditions are a little more severe than what we have here in the Santa Rosa Plain. The aquifers are a little smaller, less permeable in a lot of areas. And again, in southern Sonoma Valley, we're seeing groundwater levels that are declining at rates of several feet per year in a couple of areas. We also have in that basin, the San Pablo Bay is up against the basin. And so we have the potential for saline intrusion basin. The other thing that that plan did is it really kind of laid the groundwork for some of these, the two recharge studies that I described. There's a lot of interest in recharge from the stakeholder group in that basin, and it really got those studies off the ground. There's also a lot of interest in smaller scale recharge, low impact development type projects that have really, I think, gotten the community a little more engaged and interested in those types of projects. But with the declining groundwater levels, what we have, we recently did a 5-year review, and with that 5-year review, the Basin Advisory Panel there has recommended that we do an alternatives analysis specific to those areas as to what should be done to stabilize and ultimately recover those declining groundwater levels. So that's what we're kind of in the middle of right now, looking at kind of just not just whether we need to do enhanced recharge, not just whether we need to expand our recycled water deliveries there to increase to reduce groundwater pumping, but whether the panel thinks that there's other water demand solutions that need to be instituted as well. So we're kind of in the middle of that process there. So there's some lessons learned for sure, and but every basin's different as well, and so we'll see how things play out here.
Well, one thing that I've certainly been observant of is the fact that statewide, the policies that get made statewide play different everywhere simply because of the hydrologic difference that's out there, right? The things that are done with recycled water in the Southland are just vastly different than we have here. I think we all bump up against anti-degradation too. We have the blessings of high-quality groundwater, and with ASR, that's an interesting equation. I read the work plan that was put forth as part of your pilot project, and I understand some of the challenges that perhaps fit into that equation. I think also, though, I've in the past seen like the Niles Canyon recharge area, which is quite interesting as a managed groundwater recharge and more from a surface perspective. And I think part of that has to include then the recharge areas and protection enhancement of recharge for the basically high-value, low-cost that has protect. And by the way, I think that reaches also into some of the components of restoration or ecological component to that, whether it be our stream corridors where we have gaining and losing, and those are our high-value areas. I think we as policymakers, whether it be Regional Board, State of California, or our governance within the county or our cities, that those need to be recognized for what they are. And the palette things, I'm sure that's in the mix. As I read the legislation that was recently adopted, there's some real big generalities in there, and there's really big chances, I think, or really big opportunities to fill in those blanks. I really do appreciate the efforts from all of you as far as filling in those blanks ahead of the curve here. I think it goes a long ways towards figuring out ahead of the curve instead of behind it where we're going to be and where we want to go. So I appreciate that.